remember what your feelings were when you returned to the stock exchange after the end of the war?
I think it was enormous relief to start with, because I then had one child, I think, and shortly after another one. I thought, in fact, I was very well off, because I remember I had £1,200 in the world at the end of the war, because one saved a bit of money. But then I realised education was coming, and that wouldn't last very long, and in fact, one had a reasonable return, and I can't remember what it was. It depended, what people probably don't realise now, in those days, the partners as such were never paid any salary like they are today. They drew X percent, whatever it was, on the profits of the year. And if there was a loss, they lost money. They weren't paid any salary as such. And the staff had their salary, and if we made money, they got a percentage of that, which I think in those days we used to give about 5%. But if we lost money, they didn't get anything. And we lost it. There was no automatic. So you never really knew, like you would today, when all these boys are paid these high sums. You couldn't say that you were earning so-and-so. You just earned what you made. There was never any question of a salary, once you were a partner.
Did many of you return to the firm after the war?
Well, on the, what you might call the executive side, there were only, in those days, there were four of us, I think. One was a Purnell who didn't last long, and there was Dick Wilkins, Dick Russell, myself. We were the only three, I think, what you might call authorised dealers of the executive type that returned, as far as I remember.
Did you return to the same book?
Yes. Certainly for myself, I returned to the Colonial book, which I think very shortly after that, this Longard Higgins, his then senior partner, who was not very popular, and particularly Dick Wilkins didn't get on with him. And eventually they had a conference. I wasn't actually in it, I think, but he was more or less presented with the fact that either he'd got to go or we would go. And in fact, he gracefully did retire and leave his money in. And we had no money. All the money really in those days belonged to ex-partners of the firm. And I do remember shortly after we took over, which we rarely did, Dick Wilkins, I think, took over the government book, and I took over the Colonial book, and Dick Russell took over the corporation book. Anyhow, we lost a lot of money. And I remember walking up and down my house wondering whether I ought to sell it, because I was owing money overall if I'd been run over by a bus or anything. And Higgins came up one day and said, "How are we doing?" And one of them said, "Well, we lost all our money and we're starting on yours." And he thought it was a great joke and roared with laughter. He didn't realise, in fact, it was the truth.
Was there a particular reason why you were losing money at that stage? Were markets generally very difficult?
No, I think it was merely that we'd got rid of them and they'd run it and we had to learn the hard way. And I think it did us a lot of good. When your back's up against the wall, you learn fairly quickly. Mm. And I think we learned how to do it. And we then did become, without question, very much the market leaders for a number of years. I think we outstripped Francis and Acquarella, etc.
What were the reasons for that?
I think we were pretty professional. I think the basic reason was, shortly after I left the Colonial book, I went on to the government book. And we had in Dick Wilkins a wonderful contact man. He was the sort of person who could walk into any room and everybody would eat out of his hands. It didn't matter whether they were Rose Sweepers or the Royal Family or anybody else. He had this electric power, and he could go to the government of the Bank of England or the government broker, it didn't matter who it was, or the clerks who dealt with it. He had this magnetic power, of, they all wanted to please him, and he was wonderful at finding out anything that one wanted to know. And I think I was a fairly good technician. And between the two of us, I think we got the reputation for doing it. But without his, I don't think he was, he was wonderful at avoiding making a price. Normally, a normal individual, people would go to several people to make a price. But Dick Wilkin would say, well, what do you want to do? And they would tell him, which made it very much easier. And he was, he's the biggest character. I'm 75 years old. And I only met Winston Churchill once, but outside him, I think he's the biggest character. Like him or not, most people did, but not everybody. He was certainly the biggest character that I've ever come across, which I'm sure you will have found by talking to other people. And I probably knew him better than anybody. He was my best man, though we got a little further apart towards the end of his life, when he joined. But that's another story.
You said you were the technician. What did that mean in practice?
Well, I was the one who said what prices we will make. There was always one chap really in charge, and we used to have a big board, and one of the things to do, you would suddenly write up different prices on your board to somebody else. And I was, you have a morning's conference, and I was used to one who said, I think the market's going to go better, or I think it's going to go easier. And yes, I was the person who basically decided what the policy for the day was. If I wanted to find something out, what the government broker was likely to do or something, I just said to Dick, you know, when can you find out? And he'd be jolly good at that. I'm not saying he did anything he shouldn't do, but he just had a way with him that everybody would, amazing person. If you've never met him, an amazing character.
What were the other factors that would go into the price that you would make? You'd be changing the price during the day also.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things a jobber hates is when nothing's happening. So very often, I'd come back from lunch, perhaps a good lunch, come back from lunch, and I'd suddenly mark everything up a quarter or down a quarter when there was nothing going on. And then some people would say, well, he knows something. Other people would say he was bluffing. It very often started some business going, and some people would buy because he said, oh, well, he's marked them down, but he doesn't know anything. And very often you could stir up some business and make some business by doing that sort of thing. And one was continually, in fact, I used to be slightly unpopular, I think, sometimes by altering the prices too often. But I found that it stimulated business, and very often they thought you were busting, sometimes you were. Mm. It was rather like a game of poker or a thing. And as we were dealing in fairly big amounts, you could make or lose money quite quickly. Mm.
Were there occasions when you did make or lose a lot of money?
Oh, indeed. Mm. Oh, yes. I mean, there were sort of 3 days at a time when I couldn't sleep or anything, when things were going wrong, obviously. And other days, yes, when you could make... We're talking relative sums now, obviously. You could make big money overnight, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I know Ackroyd used to say they made most of their money in 1 month in the year. I think that was an article quite long in the other one. The answer was really jobbing. When things were bad, you had to lose as little as possible. When things were good, you had to make as much as possible. That was really the secret of it. No good trying to make money all the time.
Did you have a particular approach to jobbing? Did you, for example, prefer to be a bear rather than a bull, or did you tend to...
I think, to be absolutely honest with you, I think I preferred to be a bull, though obviously in the government market it's a bear market, because all governments inflate. But it's relative, and it usually used to fall fairly quickly and then go up rather more slowly. And I think we usually made money on... I think in latter years, when Ackroyd, I think, were... We were more comfortable than they were when they were young and hungry. The Pepiots were a generation younger than me. I think they were more able and better, more able but better advised. And I think they ran a bear position much bigger than we ever did. And I think as a result, they rather took the business away from us towards the end of my time, I think. Mm-hmm. Probably my fault.
Going back to the post-war period, can you remember much about the atmosphere in the gilt market at this time? Was it an active market, or was it one quite depressed?
Well, in the post-war period?
Yes, yes.
I don't remember. I think one was so interested in one's own little circles. I don't think one looked beyond the next day much. I don't think one looked at the big picture. It was only later on, when you got to be a huge firm, when we joined the Lacquer and that sort of thing, that you then looked at the thing much bigger. I think in those days you had a very narrow view in the market. I don't think you worried about anything about making, except about making some money the next day, I'm afraid. I think it was.
Did the first big devaluation in 1947 affect the firm? Were you caught out with big positions? Or?
I don't remember being ever caught out particularly, no. Mm. No.
And as you began to settle back into the post-war, well, into the way of the stock exchange, did you begin to cast your thoughts towards the future? Did you have any plans for the future, or were you quite content to keep the firm going as it was?
Speaking personally, yes indeed, because it became obvious that one was going to have plenty of capital. And in fact, it came down after a time. There's only two of us in the firm, of which I was one, had retained or kept much capital. And therefore it became a very dangerous looking position. So it was quite obvious really that we'd have to amalgamate with somebody. Capital is a funny thing. It's no good just having a lot of capital. And you don't really need capital if you've got a money-making business, because you can borrow it. And therefore, what's happening today, I think, is very obvious. If you have too much capital, it isn't any good, because you go and lose it. We had no difficulty when we were making money in virtually borrowing what we wanted to borrow. But having said that, the thing got so much bigger, you obviously had to have a bigger base. And so it was obvious we had to join. I actually didn't personally wanted to join Val Powell's firm, point of fact. But Dick Wilkins didn't particularly get on with Val's father. And the Lacquer were obviously the biggest fish in the area, and they were very keen to join us. I personally was not keen to join them for various reasons. But in the end, I gave way and said that we should, because there was no alternative, really. Pynchon weren't any good. There wasn't really anybody else. We couldn't join with Ackroyd because they were, you know, on the opposite camp. So it was really the Lacquer. And the chief reason I didn't like it, because it then became so enormous, one lost the personal touch. Whereas I knew all the staff of the Wedgeoffs and things. Once we joined them, there were hundreds of them, and in a way I felt I was signing my own death warrant in that I would not enjoy it as much once we became a very large firm, which in fact was true, and part of the reason I retired at the age of 59.
How had your career with WED developed? Had you stayed on the same book during that time?
Yes, I started on the Colonial book before the war and went on, I suppose, for about 2 years after the war. I can't remember the exact date. Mm-hmm. I then switched to the main government book, on which I was until I retired.
Mm-hmm. How would you contrast the main government book with the Colonial book?
In the days before the war, when the Colonial book was much bigger, the profit and loss on the Colonial book was, I'm guessing, would be somewhere near three quarters of the government book. It was quite a big book. Latterly, of course, all the colonies disappeared, and so the government book really, colonials and corporations really didn't count. That was why I actually saw that coming, and that was why I switched from the Colonial book to the comic book, because clearly I was on a dying book, and I was on the main government book for the rest of my career.
Was it a very active market?
Oh, very. Mm. Yeah. Most of the time.
Were you seeing different brokers to the brokers that you'd seen on the Commonwealth book?
Some of them. Big difference, really, was, of course, the government broker. The government broker was all-powerful, or rather his minions were, because you had to get on with them, because they had enormous power, obviously, because they dispensed all the government business, and they handled the tap stocks and everything. So they were vitally important. Yes, it was different. I mean, people like Pembroke Boyle, who were well-known Guildhall jobbers, they didn't deal in the colonial market much or anything. Yes, it was a slightly different, but they were much the same old people, Seabag and Scrimgeour and Mullins and Pembroke Boyle and things. One knew them all, so it wasn't much of a switch, really. But the government broker was the all-powerful. He could make or mar your career, really, I think.
Did you have any contact with the institutions behind the government broker, for example, the Bank of England?
I would think certainly Dick Wilkins did towards the end of the time. Personally, myself, no. But we had a certain amount of contact with the merchant banks, but certainly with the discount market, not so much American banks, but with the discount market, yes. Mm. Marginal.
Mm. And would that be outside of the house?
Yes.
What would those contacts involve? Would they be social contacts or...?
This was really more on the short book, which I was not concerned with. And I think they used to liaise about the market, and occasionally they used to offer a big line of stock direct to the discount market, but of course it always had to go through a broker. They would nominate a broker, but there was a certain amount of contact towards the end of times, which I'm not sure was strictly legal or strictly practice. But yes, it got so big that there was contact, but mostly on the short side, with the discount market and things. And the Bank of England didn't come to it, but certainly I think Dick Wilkins used to talk to the governor. He made personal friends of all the people that were in high places. He was very good at that. But really, everything had to go through officially through the government broker. You could ask to see the... Well, I met the governor once or twice, but you had to see him through the government broker, obviously, through the correct channels.
And what kind of relationship did you have with your own banks in terms of providing you with additional capital when you needed it?
Mostly done, very little personally. I think it's mostly done through the office, people like Gerald Dennis, who had close contacts with us. And it was built up over many years. And just occasionally we came into it if there was a crisis or something of that sort. But day to day, you know, it was run by the office.
Mm-hmm. And did you have much contact with the press? Would they use you as a
source? Oh, yes, the press used to come personally, I think, right up to the end. The Times used to come and see me every day. Mm-hmm. Or Constantine died. yes, they used to ring up and come and see us when there was anything of importance.
Now, how did the firm develop until the merger with Dulacca? Was it steadily increasing in size? Were you taking on
additional deals? No, I think it was totally
deals?
Static. Mm. I think there were about 10 partners or 12, or might have been 14 partners or something like that. It wasn't until we joined Dulacca. Mm. In other words, from all the years I was in, it probably only doubled in size in partnerships. Mm. I think there were only about 14 of us when we joined Dulacca.
Did you have a particular approach to running the firm as partners? You said earlier, for example, that you liked to be on friendly terms and know this with the staff and know the staff,
yeah,
and so on.
Yes, I had quite a lot to do with the staff side. Both Dick Wilkins and I did have quite a lot to do with the staff side.
How did you approach questions like recruitment of staff? was it still as in your day when you joined the firm?
I think it was mostly, funny enough, family contacts. Some of the clerks used to have a son they thought was quite bright. We'd look and interview him and take it on. It wasn't until we joined Lacquer, who did it much more professionally, and they had examinations, I think, from Cambridge and Oxford and things. Of course, a much bigger concern. But until then, no, I think on the executive side, we mostly took families that were known, so, and I think we made quite a lot of errors without going into names by doing that. And the Lacquer were much more professional, I think. Part of the reason that we had to join somebody was that I think we hadn't got enough money makers. In any jobbing firm, there are only a given number of money makers. The others just do other jobs, but they're comparatively few, even in a big firm like the Lacquer. The actual people who make money year in, year out, in other words, the fair people, are pretty few.
Had you been involved in any mergers prior to the big one with
no.
Durlacher?
No, we didn't merge with anybody, I don't think, till we're doing Durlacher.
Now again, let me ask you about particular events and whether they did have any, they impinged on your memory or had any effect on the firm. Does the 57 increase in the bank rate from, I think, 5 to 7%, and which ultimately led to the Bank Rate Tribunal. Do you have any particular?
I don't remember it in particular, because one usually was in a pretty good position to have. I think occasionally you got help too from the government broker, who would say probably he wouldn't tell you what would happen or something. He might come around and say, I don't think the market looks very good or something. He would take a hint, because he didn't want us to get caught out and go broke by, you know, a big position. I think we were in a semi-informed position very often. Of course, we had shocks, and sometimes you were caught out and, you know, all that sort of thing, and you just had to cut it. And one of the things that's good jobbing is to be a good cutter.
Can you remember any particular examples of that?
I can remember one very good example. We had a senior partner, who I won't name at the time, who was clever but not a very good jobber, and he went on holiday and he bought, I can't remember, some quite big sum of particular stocks, and said he wanted, no he didn't, he sold them. He sold quite big number of them. And he said, I've sold the barrel sensor, I'm going away for a month. You're not to sell it. We put it aside as a book, you're not to buy it back. Very bearish the market. And we waited. After about a week, they went up a point, and they went up another point. And then after about 2.5 weeks, we had a little conference, and we decided we would disobey him. So we bought it back. I think it would have broken us if we kept it open. He was right, of course, 9 months later. But you can't do that in our trade. However much you think so-and-so is going to be, what you want to know is what's going to be the next day or the next week. You can't really afford to do things. So that particular one has stuck in my memory. I don't remember any. I remember being much too big sometimes and having sleepless nights, but I don't remember being caught out by any particular thing. No doubt I was, but nothing has stuck in my mind about that in particular, no.
So does sewers or...
Did...
Sewers? The sewers crisis?
No, I don't think so.
Cuba?
No, don't remember any particular thing. Because there are always small or large dramas going on all the time. Although it appears big in the papers, it didn't...
Did you have much contact with the other jobbing firms in the gilt market, either the big jobbers or the smaller ones?
Oh yes, it was a very friendly atmosphere. You were rivals, but yes, you talked together, sometimes lunch together, and by and large, you were as helpful as possible to the smaller jobbers. The rivalry was only really between the big ones, and mostly to persuade the broker to bring his business to you. If he had a really big order, you see, he would probably pick one job. He couldn't very well start going around all of them. He might spoil his business. So he would probably have a favourite jobber who he thought would be the best to do his big deal. Ordinary little amount you can go around to. But if you found out that a chap had been to another jobber first and hadn't told you, then you didn't do him very well. So the brokers had to mind their peers. It wasn't all on one side. They had to be careful who they took their business to, because they could easily be spoiled.
How could their business be spoiled?
Well, because they would go with something and you would suddenly see the market slip in a particular stock that they were trying to sell or buy or something. So you would say to them, now, has anybody seen this? If he said yes, they had, I'd say, oh, you know, we've spoiled the market. So you had to be very, very careful.
Were there any particular broking firms that Wed had a long-standing relationship?
Yes, we had a long. I don't know that I would like to answer that question.
Yes. And you mentioned on early occasions, a few moments ago, that you would try and help out the smaller jobbers.
Yeah.
What kind of situations would those be?
If the market went sour and they got caught or something, you'd buy a stock off them at the wrong price, probably, to help them.
What was your impression of the jobbing system generally? As you go through your career into the 1960s, were you conscious of a diminishing number of jobbers, or did the jobbing system not impinge on your thoughts in that way?
Well, I was on the council for a number of years, and Ken Ritchie was then incidentally a cousin of mine, was chairman. And I made a bet with him, and I can't remember when it was, but there were then about 50 jobbers, I think. I said there won't be 12 jobbers in 5 years' time, I think I said. Actually, I lost the bet by one. But yes, it was very obvious to me he was going to do that. Because on any system like a jobbing system, you'll never have more than about two big firms. The third one will get killed. You can see the same happening today on a much larger scale. Because the competition will drive the other one out, and the chap who's best or with the longest purse will beat the others. You can have small ones because they don't matter. But in the big league, no, they're going to kill each other. That's why I think it was such a very good system, because it was highly competitive. And I don't think anything replacing. No doubt you couldn't have gone on because of the huge size and business. But it was the best system there's ever been, in my opinion, with all its faults.
Were you aware, as a jobber standing in the house day after day, of particular pressures on the jobbing system or on single capacity?
Yes, but the pressures came from the institutions, who I thought were very short-sighted. For one thing, most of them, a great many of them, if they possibly could, they used to take the price in the market and deal outside. And secondly, they were always pressing for reduction in commissions and things, and complaining about the system, which in fact served them very well on the whole. And they did not like the stock exchange system, I don't think, because they felt that people like the Prue, particularly, I remember, they always used to be fussing at the system was making too much money out of them. But in fact, they were entirely dependent on the price we used to make, and it used to irritate me particularly. They'd come in and ask the price, which you were prepared to deal. And then they'd deal outside, which didn't seem to me fair. And I think they didn't like the system, because we didn't make vast sums of money, but we did all right. And I didn't think they were jealous of that, because the people who ran the business were salaried people. And the people who ran the business with us, we were principals. And they probably were well paid, but didn't make much capital. And we were lucky we did make some capital. And I think that was a certain amount of human jealousy behind the system, and they felt that they were vast things I could prove. You know, why should they give a commission or anything else? And I think it was a pity, but I suppose it was inevitable eventually with worldwide things and all this talk about capital. Now, I always think it's very exaggerated, this capital thing. If you make money, there's no shortage of capital. If you've got too much capital and lose it, it doesn't do you much good. But I think the system was and could have been adapted better. I was not a believer in Big Bang. And of course, they gave these enormous prices to people to who they thought could do the job, and spent the whole time getting rid of them afterwards. I was amazed that they didn't consult more with, I'm not trying to be conceited, but say, with somebody with experience like me, who retired, had no vested interest, before they did all this mad thing, because, I mean, you didn't need to be clever to foresee what was going to happen. And also, one knew that only a limited number of people had a flair, so it was no good just buying somebody or some name or some firm or something. I think you were going to get